seem to be relatively innocent. Some would say that the God of the Old Testament is not the same as the God of the New, and explain it away that way. But in the book of Acts, we read about Ananias and Sapphira, who were believers and who sold some property, giving the money to the church community. They told a wee bit of a lie and held some of the money back for themselves. And as a consequence, both of them fell down and died. Peter said, "You have not lied to men, but to God. How could you agree to test the Spirit of the Lord?" So things aren't so different between the old and the new. Clearly the severity and finality with which God acts is consistent throughout the Bible. So what is wrong with my picture of God? Maybe you struggle with the violence with which God acts in this story as well. This morning, I want to explore the holiness of God, because I think that when we understand God's holiness, this story will make sense. But I want to explore the holiness of God for a much more important reason than that, because I'm convinced that if we don't begin to grasp what it means to worship the holy God, then we're standing on dangerous ground. For many of you, it might be some years since you've read the Highway Code and sat your driving test. Nevertheless, I hope that you'll remember that intersections are dangerous places, and to drive across an intersection with traffic lights, you have to wait for the green light, or perhaps the red and the orange if you're in a bit of a hurry. There are, however, I need to inform you, two other ways to cross traffic-lighted intersections. The first can occur when you're extremely tired or perhaps prone to daydreaming. In this case, as you approach the intersection, you forget to look at the lights and blindly drive straight across. For a while, I did have a tendency to do this. In fact, if I recall correctly, it was when I first started going out with Nikki. And usually she was in the car with me. Actually, this morning I almost ran through a red traffic light as well, so it's not something in the past for me. Anyway, thankfully, I've never been involved in an accident through this carelessness. The second method involves a far more intentional action. Intersections can be crossed just by driving straight through a red light knowingly. I had a friend at university who used to like doing this on his bicycle, I assume to get his adrenaline fix. The point is that these latter two approaches are inherently unsafe. Sooner or later, whether we run a red light through ignorance or through intention, we will cause an accident. Now, I didn't know quite how to relate a busy intersection with God, but I think there is some kind of similarity, because that same inevitability implies if we approach God flippantly. The holy God is not to be trifled with. If we don't grasp his holiness, whether we blunder into his presence in ignorance or saunter into his presence in pride, we're in a dangerous situation. As Andrew's already said, this morning we're beginning a four-part series on holiness. And the series is based on scripture in the book of Leviticus. I don't think Leviticus holds the title for the most read book in the Bible. It is hard going with not much narrative, and much of it can seem a little bit irrelevant. But it is important, actually, in understanding God's relationship with his people, the Israelites, and consequently, his dealings with us, the people of God today. The setting for Leviticus is at Mount Sinai. The book follows directly on from where the book of Exodus leaves off. God has miraculously rescued them from Egypt and brought them to Mount Sinai. There, he has revealed himself to them, made a covenant with them that he will be their God, and has given them his law, which is to set them apart as his people. Leviticus continues on, detailing the proper way the people are to worship God and how they are to live in relationship with him and with each other. The primary concern of the book of Leviticus is holiness. Why? because the God who has called them out of Egypt is a holy God. In Leviticus 19, it says, "Be holy, because I, the Lord your God, am holy." Holiness means to be set apart, literally to mask off as separate. In many religions, it is applied to objects and places associated with worship. When it's used in this way, there's no moral quality implied. The fact that an object or place is holy doesn't mean anything about whether it's morally good or morally bad. Although the Bible uses holy in this way, the concept of holiness in the Bible is primarily associated with God himself, and particularly with his moral excellence. Yes, God is set apart in many ways. He's spirit, we're carnal. He's invisible, we're visible. But when the Bible speaks of the holiness of God, it is referring primarily to the fact that he is separate from all that is sinful and from sinful humanity. And he's not separate in the way that you describe two rugby players being on separate teams. He is transcendent. That is, he's above and beyond. I was tempted to use the All Blacks as an illustration, comparing them to all the other teams, but I thought that even that wouldn't capture it. No, in every way, God is above and beyond us. As God says in Isaiah 55, "As the heavens are higher than the earth, so are my ways higher than your ways, and my thoughts than your thoughts." Because of our sinful rebellion, we can't approach the holy God. Even Moses, with whom God talked freely, was not permitted to see his face. We've already heard the words in Exodus 33, "You cannot see my face, for no one may see my face and live." A commentator writes, "No attribute of God is more dreadful to sinners than his holiness." Repeatedly, throughout the Bible, when God has approached people, they have wanted to hide themselves from him. It started in the Garden of Eden when Adam and Eve sinned. They hid themselves from God because they were afraid. When God appeared to Moses in the burning bush and Moses learned his name, he hid his face and was afraid. In the book of Judges, when Manoah and his wife, that's Samson's parents, are visited by an angel of the Lord, they fall on their faces to the ground, saying, "We are doomed to die. We have seen God." And in the New Testament, when Peter witnesses Jesus commanding the miraculous catch of fish, he fell at Jesus' knees and said, "Go away from me, Lord. I am a sinful man." In all these stories, there seems to be a really clear understanding amongst those who feared God that to see God meant certain death because of their sinful state. In fact, it's almost as if the more God-fearing the person, the more aware of their utter doom when coming face to face with God. And that fear, I think, comes from a realization that we are not innocent before God. We have rebelled against him and cannot now stand in his presence. Even if we had lived perfect lives and honored him in all that we'd done, his holiness would be all-consuming and awe-inspiring. But we have chosen to ignore him and to do our own thing. To stand in the presence of God in this state will be absolutely terrifying. No wonder those who caught a glimpse of him tried to crawl into a hole and die. To encounter the holiness of God as sinners can be nothing less than traumatic. As we try to understand God's holiness, there are two facets that I think are really worthwhile exploring: divine justice and divine mercy. I think that it's misunderstanding these two concepts which has caused me to find it hard to accept that story about Nadab and Abihu. The justice of God is always an expression of his holy character. Justice in the Bible refers to conformity to a rule or a norm. The ultimate norm of justice is God's own holy character. The Bible clearly teaches that God is the supreme judge of the universe. There is no corruption in him. No one can bribe him. He refuses to show partiality. He shows no favoritism. He never acts out of ignorance, and he doesn't make mistakes. And God's justice is never divorced from his righteousness. In other words, he never condemns the innocent, and he never clears the guilty. His justice is perfect justice. But God doesn't always act with justice. Sometimes he acts with mercy. Divine mercy shows itself as kindness and grace. Mercy spares us when we deserve punishment. So many of the stories in the Old Testament do seem harsh. We're offended at God's judgment. Yet, from the beginning, it is clear in creation that the punishment for sin is death. In Ezekiel 18, it says, "The soul who sins is the one who will die." And we have all sinned. One writer puts it like this: "The slightest sin is an act of defiance against cosmic authority. It is a revolutionary act, a rebellious act in which we are setting ourselves, we are setting ourselves in opposition to the one to whom we owe everything. It's an insult to his holiness. We become false witnesses to God." So we shouldn't be astonished when God judges. What we should be is amazed at how often he shows mercy. And Nadab and Abihu were no exception. As with all of humanity, they were sinners, and God in his mercy let them continue to live. But they also had a direct experience of his mercy. In Exodus 24, we read, "Moses and Aaron, Nadab and Abihu, and the 70 elders of Israel went up and saw the God of Israel. Under his feet was something like a pavement made of sapphire, clear as the sky itself. But God did not raise his hand against these leaders of the Israelites. They saw God, and they ate and drank." Yet only 3 months later, Nadab and Abihu were dead. Let's revisit Leviticus. In chapters 8 and 9, Aaron and his sons, Nadab and Abihu, tongue twister, are ordained as priests and begin their ministry by making offerings for their sin and for the sin of all the people. And in chapter 9:22, we read, "Then Aaron lifted his hands towards the people and blessed them. And having sacrificed the sin offering, the burnt offering and the fellowship offering, he stepped down. Moses and Aaron then went into the tent of meeting. When they came out, they blessed the people, and the glory of the Lord appeared to all the people. Fire came out from the presence of the Lord and consumed the burnt offering and the fat portions on the altar. And when all the people saw it, they shouted for joy and fell face down." And it's at this moment, when Moses, Aaron, and all the people are prostrate before God in awe, that Nadab and Abihu present this offering which is contrary to God's command. Aaron's sons, Nadab and Abihu, took their censers. Censers were probably metallic dishes where incense was offered. They were to be filled with coals from the main altar. So Aaron's sons, Nadab and Abihu, took their censers, put fire in them, and added incense. And they offered unauthorized fire before the Lord, contrary to his command. So fire came out from the presence of the Lord and consumed them, and they died before the Lord. there's not enough detail in these verses to work out in what way their action was contrary to God's command. It may have been that they offered their offering on the altar of incense, which was reserved for the once yearly sacrifice of atonement. It may have been that their offering was not offered at the correct time, or that the fire was not taken from the altar. Whatever the case, Nadab and Abihu presumed that they could decide how they approached God. They thought that they could ignore God's commands and set their own rules. They presumed they could approach God on their own terms. As the other Israelites prostrated themselves before God in reverence, Nadab and Abihu waltzed into his presence in arrogance. The Israelites had disobeyed before, and he had shown mercy. Perhaps they had come to expect that he wouldn't act in justice. And although on so many occasions before and so many occasions since God has shown mercy, not meting out the deserved punishment, this time he withheld his mercy. In one sense, punishment came because Nadab and Abihu flaunted their rebellion against God, despising his holiness and grace. But in another, they are no worse than any of the other Israelites who rebelled against God on numerous occasions. God chose to withhold his mercy. And perhaps it was because of their position of responsibility as priests whose task was to remind the people how they were to approach and worship God. And so Moses reminded their father, Aaron, that God is holy. Among those who approach me, I will show myself holy. In the sight of all the people, I will be honoured. And Aaron, whose heart must have been filled with anguish and dismay, knows that God is just in his judgment. He can do nothing but remain silent. As I've been reading and thinking about the holiness of God, it's been clear to me that my picture is not right. I've not understood fully that he is above and beyond me in every way. I've not understood fully that to come into his presence is terrifying. I need to regain my fear of God, a true vision that he stands above all else, and that compared to him, all else is temporary and trivial. And it concerns me too that, like Nadab and Abihu, we can so easily begin to take God's mercy for granted, to become so used to his grace that we show contempt for it. God's justice and mercy found their ultimate expression when Jesus died on the cross. Christ, who was without sin, took our place on the cross, taking our punishment so that the justice of God would be upheld. And in that one act, God's great mercy is revealed to us, that we can now come before him. The physical sacrifices which Nadab and Abihu would have made as priests were a picture of the sacrifice that Christ has made once for all of us. Yet, even though we know about Christ's sacrifice and have trusted in him to take away our sins, we are as much in danger of as Nadab and Abihu of taking God's mercy for granted. I remember the first time I got a parking fine. I had heard that sometimes the city council parking office were lenient. So I wrote a grovelling letter explaining in great detail how I admitted doing wrong, but due to various circumstances beyond my control, I was in a difficult situation when I had parked my car. Would they please, please be lenient? And to my surprise, they responded actually and said they would overlook the fine this time. Sometime later, I got another parking fine in a rental car that I'd hired with some friends. And I said to them, I remember saying to them with quite a lot of confidence, don't worry about this, leave it to me, I'll write a letter and it'll be fine, we'll sort this out. Well, The council wrote back saying effectively, "Tough. You've now only got 30 days to pay your fine before we take legal action." It was strange though, because for some reason, when I got that reply, even though I was clearly had parked illegally, I was annoyed. They hadn't let me off this time. Somehow, after only one dose of mercy, I was outraged when actually justice came. And with God's mercy so freely available through Christ, it can be easy to take it for granted. The grace God offers to us is not cheap grace. When we encounter God in his holiness, we are reminded of the enormity of our sin and the desperateness of our situation. And it's only in that place that we can fully appreciate the depth of his grace. I'll say that again. When we encounter God in his holiness, we are reminded of the enormity of our sin and of the desperateness of our situation. And it's only in that place that we can fully appreciate the depth of his grace. If you are aware of God's holiness and of the desperateness of your situation, but haven't experienced God's grace, I encourage you to make peace with God today. Myself or Andrew, or I'm sure another Christian that you trust, will be happy to talk and pray with you. And if you have experienced his grace through Jesus, but like me have started to take it for granted, losing sight of God's holiness, perhaps now is a good time to ask him for a fresh picture of himself. It's a dangerous thing to approach God's holiness trusting in our own strength. But for those who recognize their rebellion and their desperate need of him, he has provided a way through Christ to stand before him with confidence. It says in Hebrews 10:19, "Therefore, brothers and sisters, since we have confidence to enter the most holy place by the blood of Jesus, by a new and living way opened to us through the curtain, that is his body, and since we have a great high priest over the house of God, let us draw near to God with a sincere heart and full assurance of faith." It struck me that just before Nadab and Abihu made their offering, in Leviticus, the people had somehow captured what it really means to worship God. It says that, "And when all the people saw it, they shouted for joy and fell face down." Somehow the people have captured that combination of knowing the fear of God, of his holiness, and of falling face down, but at the same time of knowing his goodness and his grace to us, and being overjoyed and overwhelmed with that, with the knowledge of that, of his goodness and his grace. And as we come to communion now, we celebrate that through Christ's death and resurrection, we can come before God with confidence. So as the Israelites came before God to worship him, let's come before him now with joy in our hearts at his great gift of grace to us, but also with that true fear that we stand before a holy God.